You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
I don't think I've written a book that you couldn't describe in a single sentence and kill everybody's interest in it, in the subject. They're all potentially really boring subjects.
Hello, welcome to The Decline Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. My guest today is Michael Lewis. Michael Lewis is someone who almost needs no introduction, but in case he needs an introduction for you, he's the author of Moneyball, of Liar's Poker, of The Fifth Risk, of a book we talk about a lot here, Trail Fever, which is one of my favorite books from the campaign trail, about the 1996 presidential campaign. And he's the host, the author, I don't know. He is the guy behind the new podcast series Against the Rules, which has been is a really fascinating podcast project looking at the fall and diminishing of umpires, of people who actually keep the rules in everyday life. I have, as almost all writers do, admired Michael for a long time, and I was excited to get this chance to talk to him, and he was not what I expected at all, and it was not what I expected at all in the best possible way. I don't know. I'm a writer. I know a lot of writers. There's a force to his personality that you don't often see. That actually I think helps make clear a little bit of how he does what he does and why people want him around them. You think a lot about reporting in terms of who the reporter is around, but there's also the question of who subjects want to be around. And I think you can see why Michael gets access that not everybody else does. And this is a show too, and a conversation too, where I sort of took an opportunity to throw myself into it, to make myself a little bit vulnerable to the way that he assesses people and their character. And it was really interesting to watch him do that in real time. Really interesting to watch him, you know, formulate hypotheses, parts of which I thought were wrong, but also parts of which I thought were right, and to imagine how he might do that in his writing. So this is a podcast. We get into some Trump stuff and some fairness in society stuff, but much more, it's a podcast about his craft and the way he creates a kind of writing that has made him genuinely a legend in his own field in his own time. And to the extent possible, I was trying to get him to do that for us, before us. And I think he did a bit. This was a lot of fun. It reminded me a bit of the N.K. Jemisin episode, which, as you all know, I love. So as always, my email, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Again, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. But here is Michael Lewis. Mike Lewis, welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. So I didn't want to leave this on the floor. You were just explaining why you moved out here and that it was that your stories would actually be in a drive, that the Bay Area has given you more than you would have thought.
Yeah. Well, so when my wife Tabitha and I were looking around for a place to live, we wanted not to have a move around with kids. We want to stay in one place. And the question was, where in America can we be where the books are a drive, not a flight? And at least some of them.
And this is what year?
This is 97, 98.
So we're in like tech boom number one.
And I was in the middle. I started writing a series for Slate about the internet boom, and that mushroomed into a book. It became the new thing. And that was the first example of this place yielding gold from my point of view. But it really has been true that it kind of maybe half or more of my material has been a drive. The Moneyball obviously came from here.
Oakland A's.
The Oakland A's. The Blind Side wasn't from here. However, there was the whole football story in that about what had happened to the positions on the field, and the left tackle had gotten very valuable. That was right out of the 49. That came right out of the 49ers front office, which was kind of the innovative front office at the time. So some of my book, of that, even that book was there. The Big Short, you think of as a New York story, but two of the three main characters were Bay Area based. And, you know, I just kind of, The Undoing Project, two Israeli psychologists, but one of them, Danny Kahneman, one of them, they're both, one was at Stanford and died at Stanford and left his papers there. And the other, Danny Kahneman, lived up the hill from me.
What do you think it is out here?
It attracts ferment or disruption or whatever you want to call it. It attracts and encourages people who are experimenting with things. And a lot of what I'm writing about is people kind of fiddling with established ways of doing things.
Well, why do you think it does attract that? I mean, it's been doing, if you go back in the history of this area, I'm from California, and so I've thought about this a lot. You get a lot of like cyclical eruptions of something like culture quaking out here, yeah. Right? You have like the psychedelic 60s, you have the tech revolution. I mean, it comes again and again in different forms.
The semiconductor.
Semiconductors, like there's something interesting about the space that, you know, like one day when it's not tech anymore, it's going to be something else. But I don't really have a great explanation of why.
Well, one answer is what it doesn't have. The social structure has not ossified.
That's interesting.
Right?
Maybe it won't have it again because it will this time.
If it does ossify, that's a very bad sign.
Yeah.
But the moment someone who comes from the outside feels like they're at a huge disadvantage because they're not from here, is the moment that it loses its magic. I mean, one of the amazing things about moving here I'm from New Orleans. My wife is a military brat. We knew hardly anybody out here. We knew a couple people, but we didn't know. And it took very little time to feel a part of the place.
Huh.
And that would not be true in New Orleans. And it might be true in a different sort of way in New York, but not really. You certainly wouldn't be part of the social structure in New York. I think that the ease with which it takes in people from the outside, and the ease with which it takes in new ideas. I mean, there are vices that go with this too, but I think that's a big part of it. And it's made a virtue of change. It's made a religion of change.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of like the person who has done is less interesting than the person who is about to do.
Give me the vices.
Well, as you saw it in the main character of The New Thing, Jim Clark, who I thought sort of embodied the place, he never lets anything settle in his life, including his relationships. So that almost, it felt like each day in his marriage, in his friendships, in his relationships with colleagues, you were almost starting over every day. He was starting from a premise, let's figure out why we're doing this. And so that you lose a richness. The opposite of it is New Orleans, where nothing ever changed when I was growing up anywhere. And there was a wonderful texture to life because it was layered. You know, it was the relationships and ways of being had been the same forever. And a lot of life was a dance around what that forever was. There's a shallowness to a life where you're kind of always disrupting yourself and your relationships and the people around you. There's a surfacey quality to it.
Just before you came in here, I did a podcast with Jenny Odell, who's an artist from this area and has written this great book called How to Do Nothing. And she was talking about the ways in which, like, we're moving towards a more decontextualized society, like less context of place, less context in our communication. We like tweeted each other, like phone calls have become Facebook message and iMessages and all the rest of it. And it strikes me that those two things are related, that if you don't have a lot of respect for what's come before, like context is what has come before. And if you're dismissive of that, then on the one hand, you can create a lot of new stuff.
Yes,
and on the other hand, you're very unrooted.
That's right. I think that's right. The rootlessness of the place, it's a price you pay for how the place is. I think that's right. The way I feel rooted here is through nature. The counterbalance.
That's why I came out here.
Right. The counterbalance is, I mean, yesterday I spent my day hiking up Cataract Falls Trail in Marin, and there was no one there, and it was timeless. And getting out, my antidote to the surfacey quality here is one antidote is just getting out into the woods. It's so generative, and it's so, there's so much just stuff going on, and it isn't just tech stuff, that it really is a handy place for a writer to live, for a writer like me to live anyway. And it was remarkable how sort of little effort it took to just drop in here and make a life here.
So a writer like you, you like violate all of my preconceptions about how it should work to be a writer.
No, I don't.
You do. So I've always been very much on the side of, you don't want the journalism toolkit. What you want is like obsessive knowledge about a topic. And your ability to dive into a lot of different topics and find that knowledge is something that I really admire. Why are you good at that?
I really like what I do. I think this is a big thing. I don't think of it as work very, you know, I really don't. The only thing that makes it look like work is I get paid for it. I get such pleasure out of finding a subject that I want to know more about and then figuring out how to convey the subject. So I'm willing to put more effort into it. I think that's part of it. Part of it is just huge amounts of luck in the intersection I've had with subject matter. Like, I couldn't teach a class on how to find a book subject and how to write the book.
Huh.
I can't tell you exactly how I do what I do. There's a lot of accident involved. And I've been very lucky in just having really rich material to deal with. If you wanted to take the opposing view, I'm not particularly able. If I want to argue the case, I'm not particularly capable. I'm not particularly able. I just happen to get really lucky. I'd be willing to argue that case. And it starts with, I land at Solomon Brothers in 1985 with the ambition to be a writer. And no one else with that sort of ambition is in the middle of this thing. And I land not only in that Solomon Brothers, but really the part of Solomon Brothers. It's changing finance into what it's going to become. And I'm doing it. And I have privileged access to the material. Now, that book, Liar's Poker, made The Big Short possible. In some ways, it made The New Thing possible because it gave me credibility with Jim Clark and he let me into his life. It's ditto Billy Bean and Moneyball. It opened up like the world to me and made me in the minds of a lot of people who read books looking for kind of business insight or, you know, how-to knowledge, an authority on a subject that they cared about. It's just incredibly lucky that happened. Well, that's part one, the huge amount of luck in my interaction, my collision with good subject matter. Two, you go back to my college years. When I was doing my senior thesis in college, I really fell in love with this kind of total immersion in a topic and kind of just living.
What was your thesis on?
It was on the way Donatello, the Italian sculptor, used classical sources, the way he... What he was really about what the Renaissance thought it was doing before it called itself the Renaissance. This early Renaissance Italian sculptor who's, you know, archaeologists are, they didn't call them archaeologists, but people are digging up Roman ruins and finding old Greek statues, and artists are paying attention to them in a new way. And the humanist writers are encouraging them to. What did he think he was doing? How did he use what he knew? What did he think was classical? And what did he think he was doing? And it was a wholly original line of inquiry. And it was fresh. I was way over my skis. You know, like I couldn't read Italian. But I did get enormous pleasure in that.
So how do you do total immersion in that when you can't read Italian? What does total immersion mean in that context?
The first thing was there was this completely unused resource, which has since been published as a book, that had been developed by some Columbia art history professors, called The Census of Antique Works Known to Renaissance Artists, where they'd bothered to go and try to find out when certain statues had been dug up, where. So what I could piece together, for example, what Donatello knew, and no one had asked the question, you know, what exactly had he known? No one asked questions quite that way. So I had a body of material there that was just, it was almost journalistic. I didn't have to do the original work. I didn't have to go figure out when things got dug up and whether Donatello saw them. Someone had already done it. But no one had really asked, well, what does that mean? Now that we know he saw that, how can you see what he got from that in his own work? The broader point was, I just lived and breathed that thesis for 6 months. And I still have, like every Princeton graduate will tell you, because the thesis is a huge deal there and it's obligatory. The classic Princeton graduate nightmare is you discover you have to write a thesis a month before it's due and you don't know what it's about and you wake up in a sweat. So it was a scary, meaningful experience. And I came out of it thinking, I want to do this over and over and over again. And that's kind of what I've done with my career, is I find subjects that I really want to live with for a long period of time. And a long period of time sometimes is 2 years, and sometimes it's like with the Undoing Project was 8 years. And I kind of noodle over it. I worry it in my head to the point where it can't be worried over anymore, and then I write it.
So a rule I have is that people who attribute everything to how good they are usually really lucky. And people who attribute everything to how lucky they are usually pretty damn good. And
well, but you know,
no, I'm going to push you on this for a minute, which is one thing that you're skipping over there is you're very sensitive to when something you're near is a story. And as somebody who's been an editor of a lot of writers, that's actually not an easy thing. Knowing when something you've said or somebody has said to you is a story.
Is interesting. Once had a magazine, Jerry Maserati, who was my editor at the New York Times Magazine for a decade, who I loved working with, said to me kind of as a throwaway line, he said the biggest problem in his life was finding writers who knew what was interesting.
Yep.
And that is, it's a funny thing, right? How do you teach that? Because what's interesting is seems just highly subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you're kind of, there's an element of luck in being blessed the way I think of it is this. I've been very lucky that the things that I'm interested in seem to interest a lot of other people.
Yeah, that's fair.
Right?
And willing to trust that.
And there are lots of eccentric, interesting characters who are obsessed with things that no one else is interested in. That's a fairly common personality type. People come to me with book ideas, for example, all the time. They want to write a book. And I don't have the heart to tell them. I mean, in one way, I do tell them, but I don't think that many people are going to be like interested in that. I mean, you might be able to make it interesting to a big crowd, but I wouldn't bet on it. So it is true that I've been lucky. I'm lucky that what I've been interested in, a lot of other people have been interested in.
But this is the other thing.
I'm a common man. That's what I've got. I've got common touch.
Sitting here in the Bay Area, drinking your sparkling water.
I'm an Ivy League graduate with a common touch.
But the thing that you do over and over, almost like a magic trick, is take something that if you described it, people would say that's boring, and make it interesting, prove that it's interesting.
So this almost contradicts what I just said, but I'll say it because it's true. When I'm working on something and people, I don't like to talk about it, maybe partly because of this, I do find that if people ask me what I'm working on and I say what's on my, how I'm thinking about it, they're not interested at all.
Yeah.
It shuts down the conversation. I'm doing a podcast on referees. I'm doing a book about baseball statistics.
Yeah.
I'm doing,
bureaucrats in the federal government.
I'm so used to getting
the most
blank.
Long shot candidate in the 1996 presidential race.
I get these blank stares in response. So maybe there's another way of putting this, that maybe the thing is a capacity to make people interested in what you're interested in on the page. But it is true. It's true. I don't think I've written a book that you couldn't describe in a single sentence and kill everybody's interest in it, in the subject. They're all potentially really boring subjects. I think that's right.
So how do you know when it's interesting?
I just get excited.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I get excited?
And is it a story that you find in there? Is it the actual topic itself? I mean, what latches you?
Usually a person. I mean, usually mm-hmm. people.
It is usually a person.
Usually characters. It's usually a character, some interaction between a character and a situation, an event. I mean, I give you, it just happened to me 2 days ago. I'm going to write 7,000 or 8,000 words to stick onto the back of The Fifth Risk when it comes out in paperback. And it's going to be, I think, mainly about the government shutdown, but I wanted to find a character to tell a story through, someone who had been shut down. And I found this guy who had revolutionized Coast Guard search and rescue missions with a better machine for predicting where something that was floating on the ocean would be if you knew it was on point A 36 hours ago, where it would be now. And it saved thousands of lives because they know where to look. This is a fun fact. 10, on average, 10 Americans a day go lost at sea. Missing at sea. The Coast Guard's looking.
No kidding.
Three die. And it used to be like five died. And anyway, when it all of a sudden, and I've only talked to this guy once, I'm now going to get to know him and write about him over the next few months. But what just electrified me when I got him on the phone was he was in his car and he was lost. And he says, and I said, you're not really lost. He says, I am, and I get lost all the time. And my family makes fun of me for this. This is just fabulous. Already we have a character, a guy who can't find his way around the country, who has figured out how to save people who are lost at sea.
How did you find him?
Well, there's a treasure trove of, it's a database of characters in the federal government that's kept by the an organization in Washington called the Partnership for Public Service. And they have this database because they have for a decade or so, maybe more than that, been trying to celebrate people in government who've done extraordinary things and giving them, there's an award ceremony and all the rest. And so people get nominated for these awards. And so they have thousands and thousands of vignettes about people in the government. And I was just flipping through these vignettes. And I was interested in this guy, even if he wasn't getting lost every time.
But that's great.
It's great. It's great. Right. So that's what starts to get me. I feel my palms start to sweat. I get so excited. I think this is just going to be fun.
So you say over the next couple of months, you're going to get to know him.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Like, how do you turn somebody from a character into a story? Like, you're very good at that. So what is your, what happens
it's,
now?
It's not that complicated. You go.
It isn't if you're good at it.
There are a couple things.
I'm somebody who, my journalism is like almost entirely non-people based. It's much harder for me to do people.
Is it?
Yeah. I am extremely comfortable in abstraction.
Why do you think that is?
Because the part that gets my palm sweaty is a question I don't understand the answer to.
Right.
And I don't trust people's answers in general.
Right.
I'm much more comfortable. I don't trust individual story.
Right.
Like the way I think about the world is in structures.
Right.
I think of people as like contingent on their structures. I mean, I think about myself as a product of context.
Right.
And so the way I view the world is also the way I view my journalism. It's not to say I don't love the people I write about or that I don't enjoy writing about people. But it is a lift for me,
right?
In a way that researching like the underlying question of why is polarization increasing, like that is completely natural.
Right. No, I can understand that. And I do that. And I do that much less well. If I don't have a person, I'm less interested. But on the other hand, if I don't have a question or an idea, I'm not that interested either. But so the way I get to know people to write about them is I have to spend enough time with them that they forget I'm writing about them. That's the big thing. Because normally there's a degree of self-consciousness in the beginning that makes it hard to get to them. And at some point they surrender because at some point they realize no matter what they do, I'm going to figure out who they are. And it's interviewing. I mean, in this case, I'll probably interview his wife, his children, he doesn't know any of this yet. I hope he doesn't listen to the pod. But and I go spend time with him in his house. Yeah. And the couple of tricks are just sitting here like this across a desk is much less useful than doing something with someone. I learned this. It's funny. When I was coming out of college, I applied for a job to lead teenage girls, basically rich teenage girls through Europe. And they hired recent graduates, basically of Harvard, Princeton, and Yale to do this. It was a fancy tour company, they paid you very well. And the trip was fantastic. And a lot of people wanted these jobs. And I went to go see the owner of the company for my interview. And when I got there for the interview, he said, I don't have time for the interview because they've just told us we need to move our office furniture around. Will you help me move the desk, move the chairs? And I said, sure. And so we spent an hour moving furniture. And he called me back the next day and said, you got the job. And it turned out he did this with everybody.
That's great.
The next guy who came in for the interview or a girl came in and they moved the furniture back. And because what he wanted to do is see how you were when you were doing something. And because that's what you weren't going to be interviewing these teenage girls that you were going to be moving through space with them, dealing with problems, collaborating, cooperating with other leaders, that kind of thing. And so he taught me something. I orchestrate situations where I'm doing things with people. And the things I do with them often will never end up in print, but I'll know something about them as a result.
Do you have a couple go-to
sports is great.
No kidding.
If you can do that. I mean, if you can get him on a basketball court or a tennis court or, I mean, with Maury Taylor, the presidential candidate in 1996, he kept telling me he could beat me in anything. And I said, pick your sport. And he says, racquetball. And sure enough, he destroyed me in racquetball.
But Greco-Roman wrestling.
Yeah, yes. So sports or, I mean, just do what they like to do. With Billy Bean, the best thing I found when Moneyball was to go see minor league players with him. I'd get in the car with him and we would drive out to Modesto where they had a single A team. And just the drives in the ballpark, it was just, that was very useful.
And is it tape recorder on the whole time, taking notes, or are you just taking there notes, getting impressions?
Well, so it depends. And this is just by feel. In the very beginning, when I start to write about someone, I don't usually have the notepad out just because it's a little off. It depends on the situation. But sometimes I will, sometimes I won't. But sometimes I'll just say, look, it'll be helpful for me to write some of this stuff down. And they say, fine. And then the notepad is just there all the time. And so I don't record interviews, but I do scribble the whole time.
So then what happens when they say something you want to use?
Oh, if they say something that I want to use, then I don't have the notepad out. If it's really good, I'll pull the notepad out. But I find I can get them to re-say stuff if they have to, I can go revisit the subject. I try to create a relationship that's not an artificial journalist subject relationship. That's the big point. And as a result, in the end, I have this inventory of former subjects who are just friends now. I mean, they're just in my life in a way that they'll never leave my life. There's do you ever see the movie Big Fish?
No.
It's a wonderful movie. The story is traveling salesman in small town in like Alabama. And he comes, and it's through his kid's eyes. And every time he comes home from one of his trips, he tells this exotic story about this person he met, the tallest person in the world who was 10 feet tall. Siamese twins who were the most beautiful women in the world. He has all these, and he tells me, and the kids think, as they grow up, they think, they first believe it all when they're little. And then they grow up, they think, Dad was this wonderful storyteller, and he'd make up all these characters. And then Dad dies. And all these characters, the 10-foot tall, the giant, the Siamese twins, show up at his funeral. They actually existed. And I feel that my funeral will be like that, that I've told my kids about all these kids these people I've met and become friends with and collected. And they're all in my life. They kind of don't believe that, they don't believe that they exist, but they do exist. So a relationship is formed in a way that's rich and interesting. So that's a byproduct of the way I go about my work.
Sounds like it's probably a byproduct of being good at friendship.
That doesn't hurt, right? I do have lots of close friends, and that doesn't hurt.
Because you walked in here, you're not what I thought you would be. You're like, there's much more like charismatic force to you than there are to most writers. Like you're somebody who people would want to be around.
Well, that's nice of you to say. Not everybody agrees. the funny moment with all the subjects comes when I write about them, because the truth is, the brutal, ugly truth is that up to the moment I write about them, I am kind of using them in that I'm not, when I start to write about them, I'm not worried about their feelings.
Really?
No. Something comes over me when I see a blank sheet of paper, and I do.
Because I struggle with that a lot.
There's always a jolt. Because I want to write about them. The deal I make with myself, so I sleep at night, is I basically don't write at length about anybody I don't in some way either admire or enjoy. And I assume that my feelings for that person, if they're accurately conveyed, are going to leave the reader more or less feeling the way I feel, which is a nice feeling. And I do this as a rule because I don't want to spend 2 years of my life working on a book about someone I can't stand. So many subjects have just fallen by the wayside because I find the people in the middle of it just obnoxious to me. But having said that, often I have a sense that the person I'm writing about has a slightly different view of himself or herself than I have of them. And then it's going to be a little shocking when they read what I write about them, and sometimes upsetting. So I have had subjects, when they read about it, be a little upset with me, and then we move past it. Usually the way we move past it is some close friend of theirs or spouse or child reads it and says, "Dad, yeah, that's you." And so they say, "Okay, all right." It's the jolt. I think the subjects, when I do my job well, I think the subjects I write about experience that same little discomfort you experience when you first hear your voice on tape.
Mm-hmm.
You know that feeling? It's not me. You know?
I know that feeling.
Yeah, it's just, do I sound like that?
The thing I hated the most about myself was my voice. So the idea that I now operate at least partly in a voice-based medium is a deep irony of my life.
So go back. How did you even decide you didn't like your voice?
Because in middle school and high school, and frankly, like even when I was early in my professional career, I got made fun of for having a lisp.
But you don't have a lisp.
I have a little one.
Do you?
And it comes out sometimes. Oh. And you'll notice it more now if I say it, but I notice it.
Huh.
So early on when I was doing, oh my God, I mean, I would do anything not to hear my own voice.
Really?
And cable news. I mean, I would be like on Twitter looking to see if anybody noticed. It was debilitating.
Is that true when you were in school?
School was worst.
Yeah. So what did you do to avoid? You were just quiet.
No, I just got made fun of. Yeah. That is my problem. I'm not quiet.
You're cursed.
There's a story, which I don't think I've told publicly before, but when I was in eighth grade, I was not a popular kid, like all the way through school. And when I was in eighth grade, we had like homeroom and, you know, there was like president of homeroom and whatever. And I ran for secretary because in the morning, and this is before I had much self-consciousness about my voice, you would read like this fact of the day. You know, like today, like it turns out 10 people get lost at sea every day in America. And I went out, you know, the vote was taken and I won. I was so excited. And then the teacher told my mom later that they had to yell at the kids because like the popular kids said, vote for him, because then we can like hear him lisp it out every day.
Ooh.
And that got back to me.
Ooh.
And like
Ooh.
From there. So yeah, hearing your own voice is devastating.
But so when did you first make the leap into this form? When were you feeling still self-conscious about your voice when you went into podcasting?
Yeah.
That's brave.
I am much more, I mean, by then I'd done enough cable and other things that it was clear it wasn't holding me back. When I leapt into cable, I used to host television shows and stuff like that. That was, to me, the fact that that was happening was baffling, and probably that above anything just cured me of it.
Did anybody say anything about your voice?
Yeah. I mean, in comment sections and that kind of thing, but it was working. I was getting perfectly fine ratings and being invited back. So I was eventually convinced by public response that it was not, however I felt about it, it was not such an issue that people would not follow along with other things. And so by the time I was podcasting, it wasn't as big of a deal for me, but to listen to it. It's one reason I really hate, I will do almost anything to get reporting transcribed because I don't want to have to do it myself.
You don't want to listen to your own voice on the recordings.
Yeah.
So I don't do the recordings because I can't bear wasting the time even reading the transcript because so much of it's junk.
Yeah, well, there's that too.
Right. And the filter that is naturally there when you're only writing down the things that interest you is a nice filter. I like having that filter present in the room when I'm looking at the material. You know, if it rises to the level of interest that I'll go to the trouble of writing it down on a pad. If it can't even do that, it's likely not to ever end up. It shouldn't end up in anything I write about. Relive the conversations in a recording, I can't stand it. Having said that, I guess I've just violated that rule because the way podcasting works is you got to interview everybody, you got to record everything. And I would get these massive, you know, thick transcripts of every conversation I did for the podcast. And I would go through that the way I guess some journalists would go through their interviews.
When you go through it, are you surprised what's in there?
I'm actually kind of surprised by how little surprises me what I remembered as interesting is usually what was interesting. Every now and then something jumps out of the transcript that wouldn't have occurred to me to be of use.
Are you very structured when you go into the interview?
No, not at all.
So that's an interesting pairing there. That you're not structured, but you're good at knowing what was in there.
Yeah, that's an odd thing. I don't. I like to wander in conversation. Yeah. Conversation is play.
Not me, as you can tell from this.
No, but it's play.
I like and a straight linear
no,
line.
No, but it's play. And also, if it's not structured, you never know where they're going to lead you. Like they might lead you to their childhood lisp, which obviously, if someone was writing about you, that's great material. Right? I mean, it's great material, but it suggests that you're highly sensitive to what other people think of you.
That's interesting,
right? I mean, people are sensitive to what other people think of them, but that you're maybe a bit more because you're actually not. If I walked out and someone said, "Does he have a lisp?" I'd say no.
It was more pronounced when I was younger.
Okay,
that was kind of. I did speech therapy when I was older, actually.
Right.
To try to bring it down. But that's interesting, right?
So that's
a quick jump. I'm not sure you're wrong that I'm more sensitive to what people think of me. In some ways, I think that's actually true. But that's an interesting jump. Tell me why you decided that would be true.
Your manner, a little bit.
What's in my manner?
A certain anxiety.
That's probably true.
You're a little worried about what I thought of you, which is interesting because you're interviewing me.
That's interesting. I'm not sure that's true.
Okay. And we're descending into a therapy session here.
But it's a podcast.
But it's podcast. That's right.
But this isn't because you write about people. So I'm interested to see the way you do this.
So I told you one trick.
Yeah.
The two tricks I would tell people one trick is doing things with them, not just talking to them. And the second is try to look for things that they're not self-conscious about. Like you're self-conscious about your voice. So how you're speaking, you might say the least about you, but maybe you're not so self-conscious about your choice of socks, and you've got these very odd socks now. They've got, I don't know what those are.
There's gray with avocados on them.
They're avocados. Okay.
Let me say this. When you have a new baby at home, one of the things I've noticed is laundry begins to fall off.
There you go. I'm not even sure. Do they match your socks? They do.
Oh yeah, totally.
Okay. But, often, if you look around a person's house or a person's office, or the things that are on display are the least revelatory about them. And it's little things. This comes right out of art history. When Bernard Berenson, the great American connoisseur and picture dealer, went to Italy in the early 20th century and started to try to catalog the works of art there. I mean, no one knew what was a Leonardo and what was a Boltraffio and the question was, who did what? And he borrowed a technique from that was been created by, I think, a Swiss doctor named Morelli. And the idea was, look at the parts of the painting where the artist was the least self-conscious. Now, a lot of paintings are virgins and child, baby Jesus and the Virgin Mary. A picture like that, pay no attention to the face of the Virgin or the face of the baby because it's going to look like all the other faces of the virgins and the face of the baby because the artist has a certain obligation. The artist is thinking about it. But look at the toenails of the Virgin or the toenails of the baby, and all of a sudden you'll see the artist. You'll see something he does that's distinctive and only him because he doesn't have to conform and he's not thinking about it as much. And so if you can view people that way, you can look at little things about them and start to kind of get a sense of bigger things about them. So it's not a recipe for understanding the person you're writing about, but it's a tip.
But it's a way to get leads. I mean, I'm thinking about this right now because it's really valuable to me to see you do it to me. So I'm thinking about what I think is true here. So I would not have told you or the audience here about the voice if that anxiety hadn't more or less diminished, right?
Yeah,
if I was really self-conscious there, it wouldn't be in this podcast. Like,
well, maybe it won't be.
Well, no, everything goes in. We don't edit these. But the underlying thing there, that there's a sensitivity to external feedback, is true.
Yeah.
Right? Like whether or not it rests in that place now, it's very true. And so that was the interesting jump to me, that
What did you say? You said one of the things you said that was revealing is that comments about your lisp or lack thereof, your lisp, you found in comment sections. I don't read comment sections. The fact that you went and read a comment section about yourself says something.
Yeah. Well, in general, I don't either. But back then when I was starting, I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I came into journalism through blogging.
Right.
And blogging.
I remember.
Yeah. Part of that was like, it was all about comment sections back then.
Right.
Now we don't have them because they're all messes.
Right. Right.
But back then you did. And that's an interesting thing. I struggle a lot
I wouldn't pretend to be able to write about you right now, but you spend a lot of time with someone, you develop, you kind of little theories of their character and you test the theory and it's found wanting and you develop another theory of their character and you try to figure out kind of what's going on in there, why they do what they do and how it applies to the thing you're writing about. And sometimes the things about the person are really powerful and useful to the piece of writing. And sometimes they're not. Life isn't neat like literature.
Do you worry that focusing on individual stories can, because people themselves are so idiosyncratic and sometimes such bad narrators of why they're doing what they're doing in the first place, do you worry that it can mislead from truer generalities? The specific can mislead the general?
Not really. If I feel it is, then I use only what I need. I mean, you don't want to distract from the story by getting lost in idiosyncratic personality. And I don't think I really do that. It's more using the parts that are useful to the story. The person's personality, the character is another ingredient in the meal. And if it's a really salty personality, you might not want to put the whole thing in the meal, but you want a little bit of it. Not exactly. I think of it a different way. I think sometimes people, if you can attract a person, a reader to a person, to a character, that character can pull them through material they would not get through otherwise. There's no way anybody would have read my descriptions of collateralized debt obligations in The Big Short if they hadn't been absolutely hooked by Michael Burry or Steve Eisman or Charlie Ledley. I mean, that the people made them want to know. And so I think the real use value of the characters is that. They grab you and they make you want to know.
So did you know, you had said that you often get hooked by the person. Did you know you wanted to do a book about collateralized debt obligations and you found the people, or did you find the people and that led to the book?
I knew that there was potentially a book in the financial crisis, but I was prepared that there might not be one. I didn't know how to tell it until I found this pool of people, and there was about 15 of them, who had made very big and for themselves very risky bets on the collapse of the subprime mortgage market and, by implication, the collapse of the financial system. And I did a casting search. I went and spoke to all the people I could find who had made that bet. And it was pretty easy to figure out who had done it because there are only a few places you can make that bet. And you go to the people, you go to the casino and they can tell you who all the high rollers are, and picked who would be essentially the teachers, the reader's teachers. The best people to teach the reader about this. When I found that there was this pool of people and I waded into that pool and talked to a few of them, then I knew there was a book. I didn't know who they were, who I was going to use at first, but I knew that there was enough there to write a book about them.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Shopify. Imagine an action movie where the hero has to sell 1,000 Barbra Streisand t-shirts in 72 hours to save a major American city. Save the city from what, exactly? That's for audiences to decide. But how would they do it? They'd use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform flexible enough to help your business sell at every stage of growth, whether you're the main character in a tentpole action movie or the real-life CEO of a multinational company. No matter what you're making, Shopify can help you sell it. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system, Shopify offers the flexibility to support your operation. They also offer something called Shopify Magic, an AI-powered helper created to help you stress less and sell more. Try it for yourself. You can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Vox. You can go to shopify.com/Vox now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Vox.
Do you ever go into one of these projects and find a tension between the topic you really want to cover and the story, the person whose story really grabs you? So like you find someone you want to write about CDOs, and what you find is someone who is in an adjacent field, but it's like it's almost there and they're great.
Oh, that's interesting. That's not something that resonates with me. Because I don't really go in wanting to write about CDOs. I want to write about why these people didn't make the mistake.
Got it. It's how you structure the underlying question.
That's right. So the question I'm trying to answer is different. And in the bargain, I'm going to have to explain some things because they had to explain some things. But I'm not thinking about, I want to write about CDOs or even in the abstract about the financial crisis. I was really wanting to know why some people missed it.
Let me ask you then, because that's such a great way of putting that. So I want to go through a couple of your books and ask you what you thought the question of them was.
All right.
It's like the fifth risk.
There were two that leaped to mind. One was, what is the consequence of a president, Trump, who has got a world historic indifference to the enterprise he's meant to run, the federal government? Like, what are the risks involved of this enterprise landing in such unprepared hands, such willfully unprepared hands? So then the second thing was, what is it about the people who are doing the jobs in government that make them want to do it? I'd be furious. I mean, the way I'd be just watching politicians get up and bash. It's like, why? It would be as if you worked for Apple and the CEO of Apple every day got up and said how horrible Apple was and how horrible the people who worked in Apple was. And they only went looking for people who made mistakes at Apple. And then those people were pilloried. And anybody who did really good things inside of Apple and made it better got no attention whatsoever. What is it about these people? Who are these people who will not just go to work in those conditions, but work and embrace these big challenges? So those were kind of two things. But the big thing was, I mean, I groped my way towards the first question was the initial question, because when Trump was elected, I had this pit in my stomach. I mean, a lot of people did, but it took me a while to frame the question. And I finally framed it in terms of risk, that I'd come out, just finished a book, The Undoing Project, about how imperfect human beings are when they're moving through the world, trying to gauge probabilities, trying to judge risk, and there are some systematic errors they make. So in a funny way, it became a natural extension of that to ask, what are the risks that the federal government are managing that we are not perceiving properly and that may kill us because this guy ended up in charge of it?
Trail fever.
So that started not as a book, but as a series of magazine pieces for the New Republic. That very quickly I decided, this is a book. I'm going to do what Dickens did. I'm going to write my novel and serialize it kind of on the fly and not knowing where it's going to end. I'm going to be publishing the beginnings of it. The New Republic sent me out to cover the 96 presidential campaign. The 96 president, the candidates, Bob Dole and Bill Clinton, were effectively inaccessible, that you could interview them if you really wanted to, and you get very little out of it. And there was a massive enterprise called the American media that was spending all of its time trying to find out one little thing about Bob Dole or Bill Clinton. And I decided that more interesting than that was everything else around the presidential campaign. Like, it was that, one, there were all these people running for president that no one was paying attention to because they weren't going to win, but they had passionate followings, small passionate followings. But nevertheless, they told you something about the country, that 50,000 people wanted this person to be president. And I had respect for the level, the intensity of the interest that people, the supporters had in these more marginal candidates. And it was actually in contrast to the kind of tepid support that both Dole and Clinton seemed to have. Like, people were kind of around for business reasons. They didn't love them. And so I started to, I viewed my, my first take on the situation was, if I follow the more marginal people, I'll get to something real. That everybody, they're running, and the people who are interested in them are really interested in them if for authentic, not business reasons. And that's, that took me off in a, on a jag. And it also gave me material, you know, that, that I could write about from week to week. And then what happened is I discovered this guy, Maury Taylor, who was going to spend $7 million getting 7,000 votes in Iowa, New Hampshire.
He's sort of like the Howard Schultz of the Democratic.
But you know what he is? He's a forerunner of Trump in some ways, without without the malice,
yeah,
but with actual business ability. But
what was his business? What did he do?
He still does. He's got a company called Titan Tire and Wheel, and it makes giant tires that are bigger than you or me, for machines that are 10 times bigger than you or me. And very successfully. He's exactly, you know, he is, if you were going to pick a business, if you believe that that what you need most to be president is business aptitude, which I don't, but if you believe that, he's exactly the guy you'd want. And he had not a mean bone in his body, and had a kind of humanity about him that I found quite moving and interesting. And he was funny as all get out without trying to be funny. And where he had me, and so I realized I had a character that I could use as a runner. I could keep bringing him back. And he, even after he got out of the race, as a kind of everyman commentator on this process. But where he actually had me, and I had tears running down my face. I was laughing so hard. Is he was marched into this public school in Iowa, like an ordinary presidential candidate. Indeed, he was treated like an ordinary presidential candidate. He was on the stage in the debates with Bob Dole, and, you know, he was there. And
Was he on the Republican side?
Yeah.
I had forgotten that.
Clinton had already sewed up. There was hardly anybody else out there on the Democratic
side. Right, yeah, it was a contested Republican primary, of course.
So it was Dole and, you know, 15 other guys. And
it's been a minute since I read Trail Fever, but I loved it. I read it when I was getting into political journalism.
He marches into this... He gets these Winnebagos and he puts speakers on the front and blares Bruce Springsteen as he goes into every town, pulls big kegs of beer out the back and has a beer party at every town in Iowa. And everybody loves him. It's this question of like, could this guy be president? And he rolls with his Winnebagos, music blaring, into this public school at 9 o'clock in the morning, and gets in front of this crowd of teachers. It's kind of supposed to be kind of civics lesson time for 1,000 students and their teachers. And he gets down in the well and he says, the first thing he says is, tell me what the most important thing in life is. And, you know, people are raising their hand, love, integrity. He goes, nah, money. And he pulls out a roll of $100 bills. Who wants it? And all the kids start screaming, I want it. It was such a violation of the way a person is supposed to behave. This is why I say he was in anticipation of Trump, because Trump, you know, Trump is Maury Taylor with lots of problems, with vices and poison in him and all that. But it's the sort of thing Trump might do. It's sort of like stand up and actually say something that nobody's supposed to say. And that you're really not supposed to say if you run for president, and just say it and see what happens. And you could see the teachers sinking in their chairs and like, no, don't teach them this. But it was he was so funny that I just thought, I want to see where this ends. And so I used him. I mean, he wasn't all I wrote about. I wrote about all of them. But he gave me hope for the narrative. Now, you asked me a question earlier.
Yeah.
Do I ever get distracted by a character and miss the story? Now, that you could argue that there is a case of me getting distracted by a character and missing the story, which is, of course, the campaign to win the presidency in 1996, which was never much of a campaign and no one would ever want to read about it. And I say, the character changed my idea of what the story was. It was like, what happens when you move these people through this space who aren't formal buttoned up candidates? And what does it tell us about our country? So I just changed the question.
Right. That to me has always been what's interesting about that book. 96 is not a fascinating election.
No.
That's a fascinating book. And it seems to me to be the reason I'm pushing aside a questioning is if you can take a topic and ask an unusual question about it, you can get an unusual story.
There you go.
But it's really hard to do. It's hard in part. You were saying earlier that, you know, I worry what people think of me. I think a thing journalists in general do is worry what their peers will think of them.
That's true.
And
it's a mistake.
If you're worried about that,
yeah,
then what you do is you take the safe topic. Covering 96, you cover Clinton and Dole. Right. Like, otherwise,
what are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing?
Right. Now, I had the great good luck to have Andrew Sullivan as my editor at the New Republic, and he was willing to let me go do this. He saw it was more interesting than the campaign. So just keep doing it, was the kind of thing. And that was, I've been blessed with my editors. I mean, Andrew at the New Republic, Jerry Maserati and Adam Moss at the New York Times Magazine, and then I had a decade run with Graydon Carter and Doug Stumpf at Vanity Fair. It's ended. But the having people who let you follow these quixotic paths and just trust that the readers will want to follow too has been really lucky.
One thing that seems true about you is you are able to decide what your lane in is, just stay there. Like, you don't do social media as far as I can tell.
Nah. You know, but maybe for reasons other than you'd imagine. If I was really on Facebook or Twitter, I mean, one, there's all these pointless disputes that would arise. You know, you'd be, it's like, it would be like, I do feel like you're in Twitter, every day you wake up and you're challenged to a duel. And it's dishonorable not to fight the duel. And what a waste of life. I had someone call me. I had a note from my publisher yesterday from someone, I didn't get the whole name, but it was someone with a Welsh name, who was outraged because I had said someone had Welshed on their debt. And his note to me was, I want to get you on the phone to discuss this, how offended I am that you use Welshed in this way. It's a cultural stereotype, blah, blah, blah. And call me or I'll go to Twitter. And I thought, what an odd impulse to, like, okay, we're going to try to start, but I'm not on Twitter, so it doesn't matter. Go to Twitter. Fine. Go to Twitter. But my real response is, I'm Welsh. So I can say it. The other big reason is that it creates this social obligation. Like, every old girlfriend would all of a sudden have access to you and you'd feel obliged to respond.
You worried about the hordes of old girlfriends?
No,
coming
it's not.
Out of
but it's like who you went to school with in second grade. All of a sudden, everybody can get to you, and it would just be too much. And I'd feel rude, not responding to everything that came in. And so I wouldn't be able to manage it. It would just overwhelm my life. So
do you worry what people think of you?
Do I care?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I'm sure it's a little odd how I care, but of course I care.
How do you care?
I care to the point, I care in this way, that I don't read reviews of my books because I learned long ago that all I remember, even of a rave review, is the quibble. So it gives me no pleasure, and I never learn anything from them. If you're any good at what you do, you don't learn anything from reviews. I mean, nobody's going to teach you about your own book. You know what if there are weaknesses to it, you know what they are. So I'm sensitive to criticism. Very. I think that's probably true. So, God, if you're sensitive to criticism, stay off social media. And I have, maybe for that reason too, partly.
Do you open yourself to certain kinds of criticism?
Have to.
Yeah, like, how do you get criticism that is valuable?
I mean, this is a great question, how you deliver valuable criticism or receive it. And I have found just with, like, I've spent a lot of time coaching kids, that in the end, I've basically given up on the idea that a directly critical remark is going to be taken in a way that is going to improve the person you're delivering it to. That it basically has to be baked into a praise sandwich. And I have been very artful in surrounding myself in my writing life with people who are really good at baking criticism into a praise sandwich. So who they will tell me something, but it is almost never, you screwed up, or that really was bad. It takes the form of, wow, piece was great, I just wish that. And they know I'll hear it. So because I'm sensitive to it, I need people who can deliver it sensitively. And so that's the first thing is I have been careful to keep in my life. So my first example is my book editor, Star Lawrence at Norton. Star has been my editor since I was 27 years old when I wrote Liar's Poker. And he's edited all my books. And Star still thinks of me as this snot-nosed 27-year-old who really did not know what he was doing. And he's not afraid to tell me, and I'm not afraid to hear it from him. But he does it. He did it really well. You know, it was always kind of artfully, gently delivered. And he trusted that I could extract the criticism. My editor, Vanity Fair, Doug Stump, was the same way. And he's now moved to Audible and he's my editor there. But I keeping in my life people who can deliver this is a really important part of, and I tell you, one of the things that happens when they get older, if they're successful and their books sell, is that they make the mistake of making their lives too comfortable. They get worse because they cease to, nobody wants to tell them anything. Nobody wants to piss them off. Nobody wants to tell them their book is bad, their idea is bad. So it's something I worry about because I know I'm sensitive to criticism. And but, you know, it'd be very easy just to eliminate all of it, but then be worse for it.
Do you think that keeping yourself pulled back from that level of public feedback? I mean, what you're saying is you've created a world where you are not exposed to most of the feedback that most writers today get, right? You're not writing for one publication where you get a ton of letters. You're not on Twitter. You're not on Facebook.
I can't avoid a lot of it. I mean, people coming up in the gym and talking about it.
Sure. But it's smaller than if you were, you know.
Right.
And you've constructed a sort of like dedicated feedback cycles. I wonder if that isn't part of how you, what's the right way to put this?
Generate the confidence to go at the page again.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say like go in a different direction, that actually.
I do live and work in a pretty private space. That's helpful. That's very helpful. And I'm now at the point where it doesn't really occur to me that I'm wrong in how I'm going. Huh. I mean, in the sense that if I have what is clearly a kind of odd idea for how to go at a story, I'm pleased rather than worried about it. The trouble is getting the odd idea in the first place. If I think, and I sense that's going to work, it doesn't mean it always works. It just means that I do think that part of what attracts a reader to a piece of writing is surprise. And if I find a surprising way to go at a story, I know a reader is going to like that. And I like it. And I don't worry, what is the world of journalism going to think, for example? Or what are the reviews going to be? So you're right. It's probably helpful that I'm not sitting there with critics on my shoulder.
Well, the reason I'm driving this actually is not so much for you as for the rest of us, which is that I think something happening to journalism is we're becoming a lot more homogenous because we are all exposed to so much more of the same feedback.
Yeah.
We are listening to each other in this cacophony all the time. I mean, you know, whatever. You were a young writer in a kind of community of young writers once, and so was I. You were regularly talking to like 20 journalists, something like that. I was anyway. Now on Twitter, you're talking to hundreds.
Right.
And so the capacity for thought that is not overly influenced by everybody else's thought has diminished. That's one of my views on journalism.
Do you feel that in your own work?
Part of the set of decisions I've made over the past year has been to fight it. Moving away from DC has been one. And it's to say nothing bad about DC or the people there. I could just feel that it was getting harder and harder for me to write about the things or think about the things I thought were important, not the things that everybody else thought were important.
Right.
This podcast has a different incentive set than being on the news. And I've become more mistrustful of some of the ideas about what we should be talking about in those spaces. So I've been trying to, I don't want to say wall myself off. That isn't quite the right term for it.
Or create your own space.
Create more space.
Are you on social media?
I am and I'm not, is the way to put it. So I tweet out, but I don't read Twitter very much and I never look at mentions.
No.
I'm not really on Facebook. I don't do, so I have to be aware of it. And I feel like it comes to me a lot through my own work, right? Like Vox has a Slack room set and, you know, you see a lot of tweets in there. And I feel like I have to stay up on it for those reasons, but I'm not on it very much.
That's healthy.
It is, although...
Do you find you're happier?
I think I'd be much happier if I weren't on any of it. The thing that is tricky about it is I do think a lot of the political elite conversation is on Twitter. And so on the one hand, it's good to not be too up on that, because if you're writing for the audience, you don't want to only be writing for your peers. On the other hand, to recede from it too much comes with its own cost.
Yep.
And particularly if, you know, part of what your work, I do a lot of policy writing and a lot of that conversation is on Twitter. In a way, I don't think it's a good place for that conversation to be. But I think that the more, I do a lot less cable news than I used to. I think the more you pull out of these spaces, the more you're abandoning them. And if you think they're powerful, if you think they're important, that comes at a cost with some of certainly my sense of mission.
Yeah. There's some balance.
There's some balance that I don't know that I'm...
And it's easier to maintain the balance in Oakland than in Washington.
For me, for now, right? This is a thing where I can only speak for myself. Other people would have, for a very long time, I thought my work was much better for being in Washington. And I really didn't think I'd ever leave. And it was only in this period, in the Trump period, that it began to feel like Washington's news cycle was so loud that, and that the outcome of that was not like that I understood better, but I understood it worse. And I didn't know that until I came out here for 10 weeks for a book leave. And I thought what was going to happen was my work felt would feel smaller, but I would have more time to work. And instead, I felt like a kind of fog lifted.
Do you think if Hillary Clinton was president, you'd still be in Washington?
I don't know. I do think about that.
Huh.
I don't know.
Huh. So instead of fleeing the country, you just fled Washington.
I think that it's possible that we were going to make a move one way or the other. Right. That just would have been a thing that happened in our life, given where we were. There were a lot of personal reasons for moving, but I don't know. I think that if I believed that my work would have gotten much worse leaving Washington, and I don't want to speak for my wife, but I think the same is true for her, I think I would not have had the, even if I thought it would be better for me, I'm not sure I would have had the fortitude to do it.
Did you have any health issues?
No.
It was interesting to me. Last year, I went and did a piece about kind of Trump's Washington. Just a kind of travel piece. Martian lands in Washington and is given a White House press pass and goes visit Steve Bannon and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was shocking the effect on the health and well-being of the journalists in the White House that Trump had had.
That makes total sense.
Everybody gained weight. Everybody had higher blood pressure. People's marriages were falling apart. The effect, at the same time, their work life was never felt more important. So, but they were just, everybody, it felt like everybody had... It stuck low voltage appliances into high voltage sockets, and everybody was smoking out the ears.
One of the feelings of the Trump news cycle that I noticed in DC was that feeling of it's more toxic than ever, but it's never been more important. And I am not sure that's true. I think that there is a very human and very much a very journalistic tendency to mistake a kind of urgency and volume for importance. And I think a lot of the things that are really important are not the ones we're talking about.
Well, that's true.
So, like the thing
that's obviously true.
Obviously true.
We're cooking the planet, and you can't even get it on the news.
Exactly. And so, I think that there is a what Trump was able to do and helped. I mean, he's a system that is like interacting with social media and a bunch of other things. But what he was able to do is speed everything up, like a lot, and then through his tweets, create a constant sense of norm violation. Right? Like tap into like human beings, right? We're
right.
Social creatures. Every day he would wake up and violate the social norms of the group. And we are super attuned to that kind of violation in a way that we're not to say the people in his HHS who are putting regulations on Medicaid, they're going to throw people off, right?
Right.
The sense of outrage over that, it's there if you ask people about it, but they didn't experience it in the way that they would experience him waking up in the morning and calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas or something. Like a rule I have is that like political violations that people can think of in terms of their own community, they matter much more to them than things that you have to kind of do that abstract work to bring back down.
Yes. Are you saying, is this a way of you saying that your work is more important than mine? No, I was confused. I was sitting here listening to you. I think is Ezra telling me that
is that what you think I'm saying?
I know, I'm teasing you.
Because the fifth risk seems to me to be exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about.
My attempt to get at what's important rather than the noise. This is true.
To me, that was actually one of the things that was impressive about that book. That what you were able to do was pull people out and say, behind all this, this is going on. And this is the real effect.
But the person who made it possible for me to engage your reader in the subject was Donald Trump, by the way he neglected it. So I had a hook. Mm-hmm. The hook, I didn't have a hook until he didn't show up for the transition. The fact that the Obama administration, an administration led by a person who's a natural professor, who has all these professorial types laced through his administration, has spent more time than any presidency in history preparing to teach the next president how the thing works, what's going on. The best course ever created in this important subject, and no one shows up for it, it's a great beginning of a story. It's, I'm going to show up and take the course. And the flaw, the biggest flaw in the fifth risk was that, and I'm not sure I was right about this or wrong about this, but I decided right up front that no matter how well I did it, no reader was going to follow me more than about 220 pages. But that's all I needed to do was to get them interested in the subject, and then the world could take over from there. This is interesting. Let's now go look at the Department of Interior, even if he didn't. But there was a part of me that thought maybe this should be 2,000 pages long and it'd be the whole government, because there was no, my level of interest would never have subsided. I could have gone anywhere and done the same thing. Go get the briefings that they didn't bother to get. Learn how this operation works. And all of a sudden you had people who might not otherwise want to talk to you really urgently feeling the need to talk to you because they needed to tell people what they knew. So Trump makes it all possible. If he'd even made a pass, if he'd fired Chris Christie and kept the people that Christie had hired to do the transition and done a kind of phony transition where he showed up and pretended to listen, it would have made my job harder.
Why?
Because it's this great, you got these people sitting on top of the nuclear stockpile in the Department of Energy waiting to explain how it works, and sitting in an office and no one shows up, no one, and I can go hear it for the first time. The reader all of a sudden is, you can hear it for the first time. What is this thing that we don't know about? What is this thing they, who's supposed to be running it, don't know about? It was a natural hook into the thing. And so the two biggest problems I dealt with that book, none of it was, is there material? The biggest problems were where to go and when to stop, because really you could have gone anywhere and you could have just made it a life's work.
How do you decide when to stop? I'm writing a book right now, and when to stop is, it could just go forever.
It could go forever. And so I did. So let me start with where to go, because where to go, I decided, all right, I'm going to go, first thing, I'm going to eliminate all those departments that are on kind of the top of people's minds, state, defense, treasury, the prestige places that everybody knows, they've sensed must be important, even if they don't know what it does. Find places where they can't imagine that if it's mismanaged, we're at peril. Commerce, agriculture, energy. No one knows what it does. But where to end, I did not know. And the material gave it to me. And it really ended when I hit this little anecdote that I thought, that's the end of the book. And I just feel it's the end of the story. And it was, the anecdote was, I was retracking the path a tornado had taken through Oklahoma, and which is a year before, which is a really, I'm surprised people don't do this. It's kind of a fun thing to do. The tornado leaves a scar on the landscape, and you can actually follow it. Everything's ripped up a year later. The trees are gone. The houses are gone. There's a path on the ground. And I was following this path with the local emergency manager, reliving the damage the tornado had done by way of ostensibly trying to describe the importance of the National Storm Center, which is part of the National Weather Service, which tries to save people's lives from tornadoes. And he said, he tells me this story. And everybody in Oklahoma is a Republican. Everybody in rural Oklahoma is where I was. It's red as it gets. As Trump loving as it gets. And we get to this house. It's gone. Half of it's still gone. And the barn, and there's a barn that was there and gone. And he says, when he was trying to keep in front of this tornado and get people out of its way. And the tornado jumped over his head. And then he found himself following it in real time the year before. He got to this house and then he knew there was a little old lady. I think her name was Ms. Finley, who lived in the house, and he saw what had happened in the house. And he thought, crap, she's dead. The thing just ripped it apart. And he comes back later and finds, no, her son had gotten her out of the way and put her in a shelter. And she'd come back to find that her house and her barn had been ripped up. And then he comes back with the FEMA director, who's trying to figure out how much compensation various people need or how much the FEMA can do for them. And the woman, Miss Finley, is talking to the FEMA guy, and she says, you know, it's an odd thing. I prayed and prayed and prayed that a tornado would come and take the barn away, and I never imagined it would take the house. And she was distraught. She lost her house, but she really was pleased that the barn had been removed from her property. And the FEMA guy says, they asked the obvious question, like, why are you praying for the barn to be destroyed? And she said, a decade ago, my husband hung himself in that barn. And every time I drive out of the driveway or drive back in, I have to look at it and I relive it. And so she had this pent up, this emotional need for destruction, and prayed for it, but had overshot and got more destruction than she planned for. And I thought, that's the Trump story. That's the people who are, these people who are for Trump, this anger is at the center of his campaign, his success. Whipping it up is at the center of his popularity. Destruction is what people want. They want the federal government destroyed. They want immigrants destroyed. They want all the stuff they want destroyed. They never imagine what this machine that's bent on destruction will actually destroy. And I thought, she just gave me the end of the story. But before that, I thought, maybe I'll go on and do another department. I thought, why? The book just ended.
And that came at the end of the reporting?
I can't do anything. I can't find a better note to end it on. And everything else is going to feel like a run-on sentence. So, but having said that, I feel like I left, you know, 9/10 of the federal government unexplored and material. It's like, I felt like I mined a gold mine and left 9/10 of the gold in it.
See, so I have a bunch of questions about that. So do you think, if not for Trump, that you couldn't have told some of those stories in a way that the audience would have been there for?
I think it would have been very hard. I wouldn't have done it. I just wouldn't have done it. So I would have sensed, no, I can't pull this off. Trump made it possible.
The thing that I think, at least, I'm not sure that's wrong. I think that's probably right. I think, and I say this is a self-critical thing, that if we were, that there is a constant audience market for those stories. The problem is just having the separation, the time to find them.
Well, that's right. A luxury, right?
It's a luxury. But I think that we underestimate oftentimes. The audience will, in my view, the audience will respond to things they know they want and things they don't know they want. Both those work. The problem is just one is a lot easier than the other.
That's true.
And the news gives you, like, you know, you want to know more about the news, right? Like, everybody's talking about something, you need to know about it. Generating that is harder. And often you could be wrong, right? You can have given something the audience knew they didn't want or didn't know they didn't want.
Right, right.
And so there's just a lot more risk to go off on your own path.
Well, this is, you know, I reviewed a book in this coming upcoming issue of the New York Times Book Review by a young woman writer named Casey Sepp, who I've never met. And it's a book about, it's called Furious Hours, and it's a book about Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. But it's a really interesting book about Harper Lee, because what she does is she goes and writes the book that Harper Lee tried to write as her second book and never got out of her. It was a true crime story. She goes and writes Harper Lee's book for her, basically, and uses it as a way to get you even more interested in Harper Lee and why she couldn't write this book. And as I say in the review, as I was reading it, I was just reminded that so much of great storytelling is leading the reader to really want to know what you're about to tell them without the reader knowing you're leading them. leaving the reader with the feeling that, his interest is his idea, even if it wasn't really his idea. And she does this beautifully. And it is part of the art of the job is creating that feeling of you need to know this. And there are a lot of different ways to do it. But having said all that, with the fifth risk, I mean, people in the abstract all would agree they probably should know something about what their government does. It's not a trivial subject, right? It's just that they think it's going to be boring and or think maybe it has nothing to do with them. But if you frame it as I framed it, no, actually, what you don't know is going to kill you, then they start to get interested.
That's a trick in the news always.
That's right. It's, so, yeah.
On the risk part of that, you did a conversation, a great conversation with my friend Chris Hayes, and you talked about Donald Trump as a machine for ratcheting up the likelihood of a lot of unlikely bad things happening, which is always how I used to describe Donald Trump. And I think that if I'm going back to my assumptions when this all began, and then if you told me really how detached and ridiculous and eccentric he would be as a president, I would say, all right, the tail risk is going to hit. And we have not had.
That's why remote risks.
Well, this is my question for you. Is it that it's all just tail risk and he really is exploding all of it? And, you know, thankfully, it just hasn't paid out yet. And in some cases, like maybe the response to Hurricane Maria, even it has. Or is it that the federal government you were reporting on is actually strong enough that it has been, he has not, partially due to his disinterest, partially due to what he wants to do, been able to magnify the risk as much as
he hasn't been able to trigger a catastrophe yet through his ineptitude. I think the answer is both. I think that the federal it's a tribute to the federal government that is still functioning as well as it's functioning, given how it's being led. And it's a, you know, it's a giant, slow-moving thing. And the fact that Trump doesn't know anything about it. No, the narrative that he's a wacko libertarian who's put there to dismantle the federal government, and he's got, and that was why he ran. That seems to me such baloney. I think the truth is he's completely indifferent to it and ignorant of it, and doesn't see any reason why he needs to know anything. He said as much to Chris Christie. Part of the reason for this is he actually has no aptitude for managing anything, so he senses that actually, if he paid attention to it, it wouldn't be of any use anyway, because he wouldn't have anything useful to do there. It's not a problem he can solve. And then the pattern of talent acquisition, you would call it that to his talent acquisition for running the government has been so chaotic, and it hasn't been. There have been places where people who are ideologues who want to dismantle the agency they've been put in charge of have been put in place. But that hasn't been universally true. If he were more competent and was trying to do damage to the society actively, we might have seen the catastrophe already. And if the federal government wasn't as strong as it has been, and if there weren't some checks, like the Senate, big thing that's happened is that Trump proposes a budget. He probably doesn't even know what's in it, but an ideologue, Mick Mulvaney, at the OMB proposes a budget that if they enacted would be catastrophic.
Yeah.
And the Senate says, no, you are actually going to have to spend the money on this. You can't just cut that program. And so the Senate's been a check on it, a big check on it. But the longer he's there and the more he pushes or pays no attention or puts people who are actively dismantling their enterprises, the more likely something really bad will happen. Having said all that, let's list some things that are really directly a result of government neglect and incompetence. A couple of plane crashes, thanks to the FAA deciding that Boeing should regulate itself. Kids in cages on the border. That's not a plan. That happened because they've lost track of who's...
I don't agree with that.
You think that's a plan?
My immigration colleague, Daryl Lind, would say they made a set of decisions here. They knew what they were doing. They had made them before people began reporting on them. They knew what the consequences of them would be.
You think they knew all that?
I don't think they... Not in every particular, but they absolutely knew what they were doing.
You think they like the kids in cages story?
I don't think they like the story, but I think they've made a series of decisions recognizing that what they are going to do is use the cruelty with which they treat those families as a signal to the families who haven't come yet.
Yeah.
Well, like, I think that is 100%. That is,
you think if they do it all over
decision.
Again, they do the same thing.
It depends how they feel about the political blowback,
yeah.
Right? But they want it. I mean, things like this had happened before, not at this scale. And they wanted that. What they believe, right, their theory of the case is that we treat these families coming here so kindly that more come. So, like, the cruelty is the policy.
Yeah.
Like, so that one, like, people questioned this policy early. Like, this was brought to them. It was going to happen.
Right.
And they would say some of this even began under Obama.
I'm willing to believe you.
Man, I hate what they did there so much.
Yeah. So
because cruelty being the policy
But the kind of thing that could happen, the kind of catastrophic kind of tail risk that the government manages that may lead to actual catastrophe as a result of the way they're managing it might not happen for 30 years.
Yeah.
Right? You can frame long-term scientific research as a potential catastrophic risk, not doing it. The solution to global warming might have come out of research done in the energy department that they no longer fund, that kind of thing, or the ability to grow crops. If we lose a certain ability to provide food for ourselves because we don't properly administer the science programs in the Department of Agriculture. Those are problems that Donald Trump will never see, which is why he doesn't care about them. But there are sharp catastrophic risks that could happen where something bad could happen any time, and the nuclear arsenal is a big one, right? So would you be satisfied if a nuke went off it shouldn't go off in the panhandle of Texas? Would that answer your question?
Would I be satisfied?
In the sense, would you say, yes, now I see that Donald Trump's management idiocy has led to a problem.
I would be horrified.
You'd be horrified, but
let me, I think that's a slight caricature of my position. I would have said, for instance, that the economy and the stock market wouldn't have held up this well. That would have been a thing I believed about Donald Trump. Like, looking back at my own views on it, I think his management of foreign policy has been both more inept than I would have, like, honestly even conceived of. And I think the world has decided to treat us like we have temporarily lost our minds and to give us a little bit of space.
Yeah, they've been very kind.
They've been very kind. There's like a lot of people are not—
Hold our breath. This will pass.
Yeah.
Americans will figure out who they are. And
disaster response has been horrifying. But I thought it was possible, for instance, to your point about nuclear, I thought it was possible that Donald Trump would, out of a fit of pique, start an exchange that could go nuclear.
Yeah. Well,
right? And he might still. I mean, the early stuff with North Korea was the scariest thing of everything that has happened to me. Right. The early stuff where he said, you know, little rocket man, we're going to rain hellfire and fury, like you'll be wiped off the map.
Right.
And he pulled back from that. The one saving grace of Donald Trump, to me, he does not seem to want war, is one thing I will say for him.
He's a physical coward.
He's a physical coward. And I think that his view of things is that war is just a waste of time. Like, you don't make money off of it. And he has not wanted to escalate in a couple of situations where I really could have imagined him doing. Doesn't mean he won't. Venezuela stuff worries me. There are a lot of people around him who want to go to war with Iran.
He used war as a distraction if it was useful to him.
Yeah, I think that's right. But he seems to have a sight. People thought this about him early on, and then they didn't. And he has often seemed to me to have a kind of isolationist instinct, which is better than him having an interventionist instinct.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He doesn't want to conquer the world.
Yeah, he wants to be, like, he wants to pull back.
Yeah.
And then a lot of things people stopped him from doing, right? Like shutting down the border, for instance. All kinds of things that would have been just straight constitutional crisis. So he's been checked.
Yeah.
So
he's been a real test of the system.
Which is alternately passed some and failed a bunch, in my view. I mean, I think your point is well taken about the Senate being an effective check. But I also think that Donald Trump has shown how weak congressional accountability really is if a single party controls both the White House and the Congress.
Yeah.
Like that, to me, the degree to which his own party has enabled him, that to me is a real, like, the system is broken. And if you had somebody more dangerous than him in there, there would be no check.
Yeah. I buy that. Yeah.
Is that part of it? Does any of that lead to the podcast for you?
No. I should say yes, because it gives the podcast a bigger frame than it actually had when I started. It makes it seem more important. But the extent the government informed the podcast was its actions and lack of action in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. Two of the episodes are at least partly or all about finance. But the go back to the financial crisis, it was just breathtaking to me. One, the referees who didn't do their jobs, but also the referees who actively screwed up their jobs and needed reform, and nobody bothered reforming them. And that there was a constituency in place to preserve their status. The ratings agencies. I mean, it is madness that the ratings agencies are paid by the Wall Street banks to rate their bonds. It's madness. I mean, what you hope is that the financial system just becomes more skeptical and doesn't depend on the ratings in the same way. But you don't get the financial crisis that we got without Moody's and Standard & Poor's slapping AAA ratings on a lot of stuff that was going to go bad. And you don't get that unless Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and Merrill Lynch are paying them to do it. And they are explicitly, the government tasked them with that refereeing role. And they failed. And I was thinking that that's where the government intersects with the podcast. I wasn't thinking Trump, and in the backdrop, of course, Trump seems to be just regulators or referees. And he's just like, thinks all regulation is stupid. I don't know. I don't exactly what his position is on this. It's funny. I don't know if he even has one exactly, but it's an applause line he gets, right? When he says too much Washington regulation.
And he'll go both ways on it.
Yeah.
He'll also have the argument that it's all bought by these Goldman Sachs guys. I mean, there's the populist side of him and the conservative side of him. He is not a man unduly burdened by consistency.
No. And I don't think he actually thinks about any of this stuff.
No.
He gets up and he says stuff with a sense, trying to figure out what's going to get the big applause. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think following him, projecting him forward, you just need to imagine what's going to get crowds of people in Alabama and Florida get up and cheer. And that's the scare. Those are the scary scenarios in my mind, or when I start to imagine the kind of things he might say that they would like, and that will all of a sudden become an idea for him, because he's kind of like just responded to that, to the crowd. He's another kind of machine. He's a machine for destroying trust.
Yeah.
And he's undermined. I mean, that he walks into places where the trust is vulnerable and he takes advantage of the situation. He's undermined trust in the electoral system. He was going to say it was rigged if he lost to Hillary. Trust in the media, to the extent there was any trust left in the Congress. I mean, he's just done everywhere you turn. He trust in just a spoken word. Everything that comes out of his mouth is a lie, right? It's surprising to me he hasn't gotten to trust in the dollar yet. So that to your point, it is amazing how well the financial system has held up. And I'm waiting for the moment when he gets up and says, we're just not going to pay China back. We don't have these debts.
Oh, and he's hinted at it a bunch.
Oh my God. The moment the debt becomes a serious issue, which is the moment interest rates tick up some, and people are saying, oh, we can't afford to do this, we can't afford that because we have to service the debt. What debt? You can hear him say, that's not debt, that's theft. They stole that money. Now, how you actually selectively default on the debt to the Chinese and the Japanese or whoever you want to default to, I don't really know. But you just put the idea out there and you can create a massive problem. And we have this situation now. It's funny. People look at the financial crisis as, I mean, it was a crisis, but we had the government there behind it. There was a ref, mm-hmm, who was still had authority and was able to step in and just make everything calm down. When the government is the problem, you have a different sort of crisis. And I think he has a capacity to trigger that sort of crisis if his back is against the wall.
One of the reasons I asked is because there actually seemed to me to be a connection between the work you're doing right now on refs and the fifth risk.
There is.
Which is that there's a, I don't want to call it growing, I'm not sure it hasn't been there before, but there's a respect in some of the work right now for the people who are just trying to make the rules of the game work and get pilloried for it. right? We're in this very anti-elite moment. And sometimes elite means elite, but sometimes it just means people in the system. And it does seem to me that some of what you've been circling around is that if you really try to blow up the system, you find that there was a lot of stuff in the system that you relied on, whether or not you knew it.
It's there for a reason.
It's there for a reason.
Yeah.
People correct me on this, but I think it's called Chesterton's fence. And the idea is that you can't take this fence away until you can tell me why it was here in the first place.
That's a great line.
Yeah,
it's
but
a great idea.
I could have the reference wrong.
But it's a very good idea.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a certain way in which all of these players in we've like come into this moment where the idea of gatekeeping has become like intrinsically derided, intrinsically unfair. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about how much there was discussion even in the 2016 Democratic primary of like the idea that a political party would intervene in its own primary, right? Not even that it really did, but that it would have rules about its own primary, about who could participate, that began to seem unfair. We're very uncomfortable.
Well, look at the way we treat sports referees.
Yeah.
As if every decision they make is somehow tainted.
Right.
One side sees it as evidence of corruption or malice or whatever, but it isn't people just trying to do their jobs. Nobody thinks that anymore. They think ref, you suck, or we won.
Right.
That's it. Those are the two things people think. We won. Never mind the refs, or we lost, the refs are to blame.
Does it seem to you that we're in a kind of like a trust cycle, that we lose trust in these institutions that are failing us, then we turn against them, so they fail even more, so we lose more trust in them? That like there's a way in which this feeds on itself?
Absolutely true. This is absolutely true. And it's hard to see how you bounce it in the other direction. The only way you head in another direction is to have a real catastrophe. It takes a great depression to start building new institutions from. That's what worries me, is that it's going to take a lot more pain. It's going to take 10 million people dying in some pandemic. It's going to take, you know, whatever it is, it's going to take that kind of thing to biff the mind of the culture in a different direction.
Do you think there's an alternative path? A plausible alternative path?
I don't know what it would be. I don't know what it would be. Yeah, you know, we're talking about a country that I don't feel I know quite as well as I thought I knew 3 or 4 years ago. It's far more disturbed place than I thought it was, far more kind of unsettled. And so I just don't know. I'm basically by nature an optimist. So most hours of most days, you ask me that question, I would say, you know, I can see it's going to come from the Democrats, I think. Someone who can sell a vision, for example, of government to people, a positive vision, and that there will be a majority for that vision. But I don't know that. I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't be writing the things I do and doing the podcasts I do if I didn't think there was a different way out. And you do these things and you hope people listen and it moves the world in that direction. But there's a part of me that does think things have to get really dark before they get better.
I'm going to hope we get the better path. That's probably a good time to bring this in. So let me ask you the final question here, which is always, what are three books you've read that have influenced you that you'd recommend to the audience?
The book that got to me first, I maybe made me want to write, was Huckleberry Finn. The degree of pleasure I took from that book when I read it, I mean, it's out of all proportion to the quality of the book, as great as the book is. I just finished listening to the book a couple weeks ago with my son, who's 12 years old, and as an audiobook, and it's got all kinds of problems. But when I read it, it just got inside me, as did Confederacy of Dust. Comic novels is really what got me going when I was first.
Oh, that's interesting. You can see that in your writing,
actually.
It was
Lucky Jim. It was Confederacy of Dunces. It was Huckleberry Finn. As a writer, I was hugely influenced by George Orwell's essays. The power of just simple clarity really struck me all the important books in my life were books I read between the ages of about 16 and about 25. And since then, the closer I became to being a writer, a professional writer, the more I did it, the harder it was for a book to get inside me. I have too many defenses now. I see too many problems that I didn't used to see. So Orwell's essays, Huckleberry Finn, with the comic novel genre, The early work of Tom Wolfe, which I picked up when I was like, I don't know, 12 or 13 years old. And it was the first time I ever realized someone wrote a book. It was the first time the authorial voice was so strong, it occurred to me to flip to see who had written it. Mm-hmm. Whereas with most kids' literature, you don't, you know, Hardy Boys, you don't. You just, it's a book. It didn't, and Tom Wolfe made me very aware of the author. So I say that's, and as like books that are of the type I write, like long form narrative nonfiction, it was Wolfe, I think, who really just did about one of the best ones with the right stuff. I love that book. And he's a really good example of making you feel interested in something you didn't know that you were quite interested in, taking a peculiar different angle into a subject that everybody thought they knew.
Michael Lewis, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Michael Lewis for being here. There's something I was drawing out in that conversation. I think it came out, but I want to take a moment to emphasize it. Something that is important about his work, and that I think about for myself, for my colleagues, is the ability to do something different than other people are doing. And it's easy enough to say, well, that guy's Michael Lewis. Of course, he can do whatever he wants. But, you know, when he was at the New Republic, and was he in 96, and was a young reporter, the ability to say, I'm going to cover a different question here than everybody else is covering was not as obvious. And sure, he had the skills and has this kind of clearly some level of unbelievable natural talent to do it. But I don't know. I think a lot about what it takes to ask a question different than other people are asking. I say to him in the show, and I do believe it's true, I worry that industry-wide it's getting harder to ask questions other people aren't asking. I think that is a byproduct of some of the technologies we're all on together. And I don't know, it's something worth cultivating. I talk a little bit in here about the ways I'm trying to cultivate it in myself. And I do hope that doesn't come across as critical of others, because others are responding to this era differently than I personally do. And others also have different jobs than I do. So I think if you're, say, covering the Trump White House, you really do need to be in DC. But I don't know, I think it is a worthwhile question to try to be mindful about. Are you able to intentionally frame the questions of your work, if that is work that allows that? Or are the questions being framed for you? And sometimes we don't have a choice about that. Some jobs don't allow us to frame the questions, but sometimes we have a lot more capacity in that space than we think. And certainly I have more capacity in that space than I think, or sometimes than I demonstrate. And it's good to be assessing your own environment, to ask which version of yourself it's bringing up. Is it the version of yourself that kind of you're able to direct, or is it a version of yourself that is deeply reactive and is directed by people outside of you? On the day I did this podcast, I also happened to do the podcast with Jenny O'Dell, which I think is probably out by now, and with Richie Davidson, who studies meditation. And it was interesting to have these three podcasts that are in different ways about attention and in different ways about creativity and in different ways about what it takes to be self-directed in a world that wants to direct you. Davidson talks about stimulus-directed attention. And I think there's a lot of that right now in journalism, stimulus-directed attention. Trump is constantly a stimulus trying to direct our attention to what he wants us to see. And it is an important kind of resistance. And it is important to being able to see things clearly, to try to find refuge from that. It's something I think we're getting better at as an industry, but not sure we're quite there yet. Anyway, for what it's worth. Thank you to Michael Lewis for being here. To Topher Ruth for engineering, to Jeffrey Geld for producing. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.